March 1378, putting aside all shame of man and fear of God, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, the mightiest subject in the realm of England, was to be seen riding around his estates in Leicestershire with his unspeakable concubine, a certain Catherine Swynford. Not only was the Duke brazenly parading his beautiful mistress for everyone to see, but he was holding her bridle in public, a gesture that proclaimed to all his possession of her. And as if this were not shocking enough, the fact that the Duke was flaunting his mistress in the presence of his own wife created a scandal that would soon spread throughout the length and breadth of the kingdom and beyond. Catherine Swynford, that famous adulteress, was set on the path to notoriety, fame, and a great love at the tender age of 2, or thereabouts, when she was placed in the household of Philippa of Hainault, wife to Edward III of England. Catherine's disposition with the popular and maternal Philippa was almost certainly due to her father, Sir Payne de Rouet, having rendered years of faithful service to the Queen and the royal family of Hainault. By 1349, the year the Black Death was decimating the population of England and much of Europe, Payne had apparently returned to Hainault and left his tiny daughters Catherine and Philippa in the care of the kindly Queen Philippa. It was then customary for gently born children to be placed in noble households with patrons who could provide an appropriate education, but these little girls were both too small to serve the Queen in any way. Payne's placing them with her so young suggests that they were already motherless, their mother perhaps having died in childbirth. The Queen was now about 44, a tall, plump, kindly lady who was wonderfully generous, wise, gladsome, humbly pious, and greatly loved and respected. She was interested in education, art, and literature, and her charities were legion. At the same time, she was inordinately fond of rich adornment. Blessed be the memory of King Edward III and Philippa of Hainault, his queen, who first invented clothes, observed one chronicler caustically, and she maintained a large and very costly household. Her ever-increasing brood all adored her, as did her husband the king, whose pet name for her was Mine Bidini. In the Queen's chamber, Catherine and her sister would not have lacked for company of their own age. The younger princesses, Mary and Margaret, would have been among their companions. The other surviving princes and princesses, among them Edward the Black Prince and John of Gaunt, were much older and had long left the nursery. The chronicler, Jean Froissart, says that Catherine was brought up in her youth with Blanche of Lancaster, a cousin of the king and the future wife of John of Gaunt. Although Catherine was a gentlewoman, she had not been born into the highest echelons of society, but the education she received in the Queen's household formed her into a lady of many accomplishments, who was able to mingle seamlessly with the elite of the kingdom. From an early age, Catherine displayed a certain piety, which was perhaps in part due to Queen Philippa's early training. The Queen was also a practical woman, and it was doubtless from her that Catherine learned the skills of household management. The court attracted people of rank, intellect, and sophisticated tastes, and was a centre of learning and culture. Its members were wealthy, privileged, and overwhelmingly preoccupied with the securing of patronage and the acquisition of material luxuries. Display was what mattered. They dined in style on rich and novel cuisine, drank to excess, and dressed in extravagantly fashionable and colourful clothes. Women's necklines were very low, and often left the shoulders and breasts half bared, while young men wore such clinging hose beneath their short jackets, paltocks, that little was left to the imagination. Catherine would have learned dancing, embroidery, riding, hunting, hawking, and social skills. She would have become familiar with the parlour games so beloved of courtiers, the songs and music performed by the king's musicians, and with the cult of courtly love, which informed and underpinned sexual relationships within the rarefied world of castle or palace. The game and play of love was all very well, but it would have been drummed into growing girls like Catherine that they must wait to be addressed before speaking, must keep their eyes modestly lowered and their hands folded, and that they must avoid being over-familiar with men if they wanted to avoid scandal. But the court was a licentious place where promiscuity was rampant, since so many young men could not afford to marry, and frank, bawdy tales, such as those of Giovanni Boccaccio and later Geoffrey Chaucer, were very popular. By the time Catherine came to court, around 1349, Edward's subjects thought that a new sun was rising over England, with peace abounding, the wealth of possessions, and the glory of victory. In prosecuting his claim to the French throne, the king had inflicted resounding defeats on England's ancient enemy, and won high renown, a substantial foothold in France, and international prestige for his kingdom. King Edward was devoted to Queen Philippa, and they were to enjoy a long and happy marriage. Yet he was not faithful to her. Indeed, he was often passionately smitten with the charms of other ladies, and there was even an unsubstantiated tale that he took what he wanted by force. Catherine lived in a society that faced similar problems to those we face today, a post-imperial world in which people were fast losing faith in an authoritarian government that seemed unable or unwilling to deal effectively with the practical problems it faced, and which insisted on pursuing victory at all costs in a war that could never be won. Yet in many other respects, Catherine's world would be largely unrecognizable to us today. In the second half of the 14th century, England was still essentially a feudal society, with a social hierarchy that represented medieval man's preoccupation with the divinely appointed order of civilization. At the very top of this pyramid was the king. Next came his tenants-in-chief, the great barons. Then came the knightly classes and the gentry, the class to which Catherine belonged. Then the freemen and rising merchant classes, and at the very bottom of the pyramid, the villeins or serfs, peasants who were tied to their manors and worked the land for their lords and themselves. The Black Death left the world a very different place. Its impact was felt in every walk of life. Because it was seen as the judgment of God on a sinful universe, religious hysteria and fanaticism flourished, and people began to question the old certainties of the universal faith preached by the Roman Catholic Church. England was known as the Ringing Isle because of the constant pealing of bells from numerous parish churches and abbeys. The power and influence of the medieval church was all-encompassing. Many men and women, including Catherine's sister and daughter, devoted their lives to God. They entered the priesthood, or withdrew from the world into monasteries or convents, where they carried out the Opus Dei, the work of the Lord, through prayer, manual labour, and the preservation of written knowledge and works of faith, history, and literature in illuminated manuscripts. By 1366, Catherine de Rouet had been placed by Queen Philippa in the chamber of the latter's daughter-in-law, Blanche, Duchess of Lancaster, Catherine's former playmate and, since 1359, the wife of John of Gaunt. The exquisite Blanche of Lancaster was the daughter of the king's cousin, the valiant and well-respected Henry Duke of Lancaster. It was in honour of the memory of Blanche the Fair that Geoffrey Chaucer later wrote his dream poem, The Book of the Duchess. Chaucer calls Blanche the flower of English womanhood. Gay and glad she was, fresh and sportive, sweet, simple, and of humble semblance, the fair lady whom men call Blanche. John of Gaunt, the third son of the king and queen, had been born in Ghent, Flanders, hence his appellation Gaunt, being an English corruption of Ghent. All the evidence suggests that he was fond of his parents, he was especially close to his mother, and his siblings, and grew up in a happy, stable family, which was not always the case where royal princes were concerned. Above all, John would have grown up to the heady awareness that his father, the king, was winning great victories over the French in the Hundred Years' War, and that his glorious brother, the Black Prince, 10 years his senior, had assisted most nobly in achieving those victories. The year 1361 saw another virulent outbreak of the dreaded Black Death. Its most notable victim was the widely mourned Henry, Duke of Lancaster. His death brought about a spectacular change in John of Gaunt's fortunes, for the dead man's great titles and estates were to be divided between his two co-heiresses, whose husbands would inherit them in their right. The childless Matilda of Lancaster, Blanche's sister, also died in 1362. This brought John the other half of the Lancastrian inheritance. His wife Blanche being Matilda's sole heir, he would now own about one-third of all England. The acquisition of such wealth gave rise to the first of the many scurrilous rumours that were to blight John's life. In this case, that he had poisoned his sister-in-law. In fact, it appears, she was a victim of the plague. To mark his own 50th birthday on the 13th of November, 1362, Edward III formally created John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster. John, at just 22, was now the most important man in England after the monarch himself. Like all great medieval households, John of Gaunt's was itinerant, moving around the country to satisfy the demands of politics, estate business, law enforcement, hunting, and the social calendar. The household included a long train of carts, pack horses, and sumpter mules carrying furniture, hangings, clothing, documents, and the ornaments of the ducal chapel. When he was in the capital, he was to be found at his chief residence, the magnificent palace of the Savoy, the pride of his properties and the outward symbol of his greatness. The interiors of the Savoy, with its furniture, rich beds and headboards, French tapestries, silk hangings, gold and silver plate, stained glass, carpets, cushions, fine napery and ornaments, all afforded lavish evidence of the Duke's immense wealth and superb taste. In appearance, even as a young man, John of Gaunt was commanding. Courteous and charming, he spoke well, very measured, temperately and with good judgment, being self-controlled and good-humoured. John spoke Norman French on a daily basis, read French with ease, and had a good grasp of English. In 1363, for instance, he became the first person ever to open Parliament in that language. The Duke did not take kindly to criticism or to being contradicted. Chaucer, however, found John to be a wonder and well-faring knight who was so treatable, right, wonder-skilful and reasonable that he put the poet at his ease and got me acquaint with him. This was the magnificent lord whose wife Catherine now served and whose children she would care for. Doubtless she was as in awe of him as most people were. She was, after all, just a young teenager at the time. Catherine could therefore never have dreamed that the Duke's fancy would one day fix itself upon her. The evidence we have strongly suggests that he had eyes only for his beautiful wife. Catherine had other things to preoccupy her mind, not the least of which was marriage.